Good afternoon. I'd like to open the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency, Tuesday, February 4th, 2014. And with that, I'd first like to open an organizational meeting for the adoption of committee rules.
Chair Holby, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules.
Representative Lively, move to adopt the proposed committee rules. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion passes and the rules are adopted. We'll close the organizational meeting. I believe Representative McEwen is here eager. So we're just going to go a little bit out of order. We're going to start with House Bill 4083. So I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 4083. Jan, would you like to give us a little, before Representative McEwen starts, a little preview of House Bill 4083 and the documents in front of us?
House Bill 4083, it requires a person to either notify the consumer in writing or to receive the consumer's consent prior to sending any check, draft, or other payment instrument or any offer to extend credit or lend money. And it provides that a violation is an unlawful trade practice under 656-607. And you have before you a Dash 1 amendment that was requested by the committee that prohibits a person from sending a check, a draft, payment instrument, or other negotiable instrument to a consumer unless the consumer previously requested or consented to receive that. It requires the consumer's request or consent to have been affirmative and in writing, separate from any other agreement.
Thank you. Representative McEwen, welcome. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you. My name is Katty McEwen. I'm the representative from House District 9 down on the beautiful south coast of Oregon. And Chair Holby, thank you so much for having me back. I'm delighted to come once again and explain the intent behind this bill that I've had drafted. I had a consumer or a constituent come to me who is a consumer last fall with a concern. And she had a set of checks sent to her mailbox. Unbeknownst to her, the checks were stolen. Those of us that live in rural communities have issues with mail theft. It's a fairly regular occurrence. And this happened to her. She's a resident of Florence. And it created an issue for her that was an identity theft issue. There was there have been numerous attempts to open accounts in her name since that time. And it's created a great deal of anxiety and difficulty for her and something that she is still working to resolve. When she contacted me, it perked my interest because I had the same thing occur a couple of years ago. I had a credit card company send me a set of checks that I was not aware of that landed in my mailbox, and they were stolen out of my mailbox. And a few weeks later, one of the checks was negotiated, an account was opened, and it became a process of me dealing with the credit, the company where the bank where the check was negotiated and the account was opened, with the police, and with the U.S. Postal Service, and it ended up in a grand jury indictment. And this gentleman ended up behind bars because it was a mail theft, mail fraud issue, and it just took an inordinate amount of time for me to deal with. And since it happened two times, I became interested in the topic of unsolicited checks being sent in the mail. So the intent of this bill is really very narrow. I've been pleased to work with Mr. Martinez since I came up with this concept and with the Oregon Bankers Association to try and come to some kind of a resolution as to how we can mitigate the exposure of our Oregon citizens when these negotiable items land in the mailbox, particularly when you don't know that they're coming and aren't aware that you're being put at risk. And Chair Holvey, I really appreciate you, the input that you gave in providing the Dash 1 amendment to this bill. I think it helped clarify and narrow it a great deal. I actually had a Dash 2 amendment drawn today that actually narrows it down just a tiny bit more, removing a few more words from the amendment that you're proposing to try and even narrow it further, to make sure that there's no collateral damage, we're not doing anything that's going to create a problem for the banking industry and being able to offer this opportunity for their customers to do a balance transfer from one credit card account to another. I have no intention of disallowing that to happen, but I think it's appropriate that as a consumer that we have an opportunity to opt into this mailing of checks to our homes that have our personal information on it and have a negotiable instrument attached to it. I actually had to laugh when I came into the office on Monday. My chief of staff walked in, and on Saturday she received six of them in the mail at her house in Coos Bay, which is just an indication that, honestly, everybody I talk to has just about has had these arrive in their mailbox. And I, again, appreciate the Mr. Martinez working with me on this. I know he has some issues that he will bring up to you when he comes up to testify, but I do believe that there is a fix here. I do believe that we can protect our citizens from, I think, the liability that occurs when these things are out in the public, when mail is stolen. We've created a problem for people, and I think that we can come to a resolution at some point in how we deal with this. My hope is that we can do that, but I think it's a reasonable request, and I appreciate the committee's time in listening to my story, and I hope you will support the concept that we move forward and protect Oregonians from this liability that's occurring on a regular basis.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I must admit, when we got the Dash 1 back, I saw that there was a couple pieces that needed to be narrowed. So I'll be curious to see if you narrowed the same things that I thought needed to be narrowed. So.
And Chair Holvey, I am very willing to work with my friends in the banking industry to make sure we do this right. I don't want any unintended consequences. We do want to do this correctly, but I do think it's an issue that we need to deal with as
right.
a state.
Right. Yeah, and I totally agree. Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank
I guess
for your
everybody
time.
Asked you all the questions they need from last time. So
right.
Thank you
thank
very
you
much.
Thank you so much.
And go ahead and get Tim Martinez and Greg Peden. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
And if you identify yourself for the record.
Absolutely. I'll go ahead and go first. Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association and the Independent Community Banks of Oregon. I would just echo Representative McEwen's efforts on this bill and thank her for coming to us so that we could begin the process of trying to figure out if there's a method to address her issue that she's had and both and her constituent had as well. You should also be aware that she hasn't taken me up on it yet, but I've offered to help her constituent as she struggles with some identity theft issues and getting back, and I would just throw that on the record that we're certainly willing, and I've dealt with many of you in this committee who've had constituents problems with some members or issues, and we always offer that as an opportunity to try to resolve things and get things done in an expeditious manner. So it is, you know, it is what happened to Representative McEwen as well as her constituent is an awful thing, and you know, certainly takes up one of the most valuable things that I'm discovering we have as I age, and that's our time. You know, time is very important as we get older. We don't appreciate it when we're younger, I don't think, because we think we have unlimited time and don't realize all the demands that are going to be made on those. But having said that, you know, there is. What happened to both her and her constituent, there's zero in the way of financial loss. That is all protected. So anything that's fraudulently charged, accounts are set up, I think in her case, the person that stole those checks actually opened an account at one of the local, I think one of the local credit unions down in Coos Bay. And all of those costs that were generated from that are covered by the credit card company. So there's zero financial cost to that. But again, I do understand there's time involved to correct all that, and that is important. I don't want to minimize that. But, you know, you also have, you know, I think there's at least two things as citizens that we need to do. One, obviously, is be educated and vote. We certainly wish those numbers were higher. But also on the public safety side, you know, if somebody breaks into your house or somebody robs you or, God forbid, steals my golf clubs, you know, it's important that I work with police and try to do that. So I know Representative McEwen had to go to the grand jury and testify. And, again, that's a burden. But as citizens, there are things we need to do if somebody harms us. Or tries to harm us. I think some of the questions about the bill specifically, and again, I think the amendment that you drafted and that she's working on do go a long way to make it better or improve it. For example, since we can't talk about these things in the building, I will just say the way we first read that bill, some of your mail may not have been able to go to you that we would have liked to have sent you unless we gave you some notice in advance. So, you know, there was a lot of things out there. Poor grandma might not have been able to send my my sons a Christmas check or a birthday check because of their initial draft. And I think some of those issues have been resolved. But I guess it points out to me that they're, you know, the devil's always in the details here, and I'm not sure in the time frame that we have that we can get them all resolved. For example, how do you approve the 7 days? You know, at some point it becomes a he said, he said, or a she said, she said, or a he said, she said.
Are you speaking to the amendment?
Or? No, I'm talking to the bill itself. No, I'm at the bill itself. Okay. How do you approve the 7 days notice? I mean, there's going to be nothing there that you're going to be able to. You know, we had a bill a few years ago where we brought in statements and other things. And if you look at statements from not just banks, but from really anybody that you have an account with, there's not a postmark on them very much anymore that you can go by and say that this was sent on X day. And that makes it very difficult to prove the 7 days. Probably the bigger issue, and it was interesting because, as she mentioned, her staffer received one from a bank, a national bank, on Saturday. And I don't know that she's done it yet, but, you know, you should never ask a question where you don't know the answer. But I suggested to Courtney, because it's my understanding in talking to all of the members that I've been able to reach in the last few days, if you call and say, and there are the numbers on these documents, I don't want these, they'll stop sending them. Now, you may not be able to limit just that. They may eliminate all marketing mailers, but some people like that too. They don't want anything. You know, give me my statement, and I'll decide if I want to do additional business, and I'll come into the institution or call and do that. So the issue with the one that Courtney received is a matter of preemption. And we're of the opinion, and I can certainly get to your committee administrator a court case out of the California Supreme Court, and again, that it is a California court case, but it is their Supreme Court, and it made it pretty clear from in their perspective that national banks would be preempted from this. There's also very well understood case law that generally the laws of the state where these cards are issued prevail. And in many cases, you're looking at the Dakotas, Delaware. Those we used to have a credit card bank in Oregon. We no longer have that bank. So the preemption issue, we're not sure that you get any. You bring in any institutions in Oregon, except perhaps community banks. And I'm not. I don't know whether community credit unions do this type of work or not through a vendor. The other thing that I think we're missing, and I'll wrap up here, Mr. Chair, is a lot of folks do find these checks very helpful. I was talking to a staffer here the other day who had been unemployed within the last couple of years. The unemployment benefits were not sufficient, and he was struggling trying to figure out how he was going to pay his bills. And he realized that he had some of these checks and went ahead and drew cash on them for living expenses. Now, certainly we don't recommend using your credit cards for living expenses, but, you know, given the situation, it helped him get through a time until he found a job. And the good thing about that, not only was it available, but generally speaking, the interest rate when you write one of those checks is under 5%. And I, you know, challenge you to look and find where you can get money under 5% on a credit card. Again, they're certainly not overcharging. I would never argue that. But 5% is a pretty good rate. So that's the other thing. You can use these things for balance transfer transfers. You can also, if you do some remodeling and bring in a carpenter to your house who perhaps doesn't take credit cards, you can certainly write one of these and use it to pay for a remodel.
Mr. Martinez, just
yes,
to expedite the conversation,
I'm almost
a little
done.
I think we're all aware of what we can do with with monies that we get. You know, speaking specifically to the amendments and the notion that you have to affirmatively request that these things be sent to you. You can. We're not preventing the solicitation. We're just saying don't send the negotiable document with that initial solicitation, and that you can send them, but only if that consumer affirmatively request that you send those to them, and they can do that. Theoretically, they should be able to do that on the website or in mail or, you know, on the phone. And so just trying to get to that, and we can argue about whether or not the preemption issue really affects this particular bill or not, but I'm just curious what your take on the specific amendments that the Dash 1 and then the Dash 2 that evidently Representative McCune has been working with you on.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I have not seen the Dash 2s. I've only seen the Dash 1s, so I can't speak to those yet. Again, you know, I think the Dash 1, which came from the committee, is a vast improvement. I can show you disclosure after disclosure where you, as a consumer, can say, I don't want these. Mm-hmm. I don't want these. If you go into the opt-in, and let's say, you know, there is a mass mailing to all the holders of Card X in Oregon. It says there's a new law here, and you have to opt in, and you get 10% respond, 90% of the people don't respond to you. Do you just then assume that they're a no, or do you assume that they're a yes? If I'm a book
well,
of
I think
the
under the bill they have to affirmatively consent.
Right, right. So somewhere down the road when somebody... We see issues with that as well. For one
okay,
thing...
So you're opposed to the amendment too, so...
The amendment approves it. We believe that they're in the... Again... The short time frame, we think, and I've told this to Representative McEwen, and that's kind of how I was going to wrap up where I was getting to, is I pledged to her and I pledged to her senator, Senator Roblin, that we would continue to work with her and try to get a product that we all could support. But again, as you all know, today, for example, I couldn't get a banker down here to testify. We just don't have time to get some of these folks down in the amount of time we have. So we certainly knew we were expected a hearing this week, but you know, again,
yeah.
So
February is a short session.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So as the representative, the sponsor indicated, we have been working with her. We'd like to continue to work with her. We're just not sure in the time frame we have that we
okay,
can.
Okay, fair enough.
There. Thank you for your time.
You bet.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Greg Peden here this afternoon on behalf of United Finance. You may not know United Finance. They are the largest provider of secondary loans in the state. They're headquartered in Portland. They have offices all over the state. They primarily focus on car loans, auto loans, but they have other branches as well. Just to be short, I in general, support what Tim testified to. I have not seen amendments, so we were concerned with the overbroad scope of the original bill, but I'm certainly willing to work with the sponsors of the bill and the committee to see if we can come to terms, but I'll leave it at that and ask you any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is to either one of you. Has this kind of a law, to your knowledge, been implemented in any other state?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Richardson, members of the committee, to my knowledge, no. This is a new law. And again, I think the fundamental thing we have to remember here is, by its very definition, this is mail fraud, which is a federal crime, which is a felony.
Just a quick comment. I've read the Dash 1 amendments. I haven't seen Dash 2 amendments. The Dash 1 amendments, I think there may be unintended consequences to it, and so I want to make sure that if it did go forward, that it would not preclude checks that are involved with negotiations for a settlement or something like that, because it says that it says a person may not send a check, blah, 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 related to an offer to a consumer, comma, and then it says including a solicitation, but it doesn't say that relates solely to a solicitation or whatever. If it says including, that means that it is inclusive, but it's not exclusive of everything else.
Right.
And so if it's an offer to settle in a case or something like that, that check can't be sent, or maybe in other situations as well. And I would also request that LC, when they are drafting something where the attorney drafting this can see that there's unintended consequences, don't just send the thing out. Send it with a note saying, by the way, grandma won't be able to send a check to the grandchild or other things if it's spotted, rather than send it out and just hope that somebody spots it. And we really need to rely on the expertise of the lawyers drafting these things to not only draft, but also point out what they see as they're drafting.
Certainly, we definitely saw some issues with the first bill, but I think that happens with a lot of our bills as they try to gather what the intent of the legislator is. But any other questions, comments? Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Tim, I just wonder, you know, for the financial institutions to, you know, they've been doing this for a while. Do you have any idea what kind of utilization there actually is? Is there any kind of way to track how often somebody actually uses these things that show up unsolicited? I mean, there must be enough to warrant them to continue doing it, but is there any way to get that kind of data?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, members of the committee, I'd be happy to try to track that down. I don't have that with me here today. It's not something we'd asked, but we can certainly find out. I do know, you know, it, like many products and services out there in the private sector, this has evolved.
Mm-hmm.
10 years ago, it wasn't uncommon for us to get a live check where we didn't have any relationship with a particular lender, and they'd send us a live check, and it'd say, you know, a $5,000 check. Those don't happen anymore. No, you know, and I think this could be one of the reasons, because that was a valid live check. So that. Like many things, that's slowly evolved, and now you have to have an existing customer relationship, so you should not be getting any of these from anybody unless you have an account with Bank X or Credit Card X. So that has changed. There used to be a small liability to the customer, a small amount. That's now been changed to zero. So again, from a financial perspective, you should not be harmed when something like this happens. But again, your time and working with the police and all that stuff is still going to be there. And I will try to see if I can't get some. But again, there, from what I heard from the folks I've talked to, is there is a significant amount of folks that find them handy, especially, you know, they're not as many as there used to be, but on those balance transfers when people wanted to go, you know, you could every 6 months go from zero to zero to zero to zero. Because at some point you're looking at an economy of scale. It costs you the same whether you send out a million credit cards statements or 5 million credit card statements. So, you know, there is that. But though, you know, again, those zero interest ones are not as many as they used to be either. So, I'll try to see what I can find out. Long way of saying I'll try.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you. Well, given your testimony, I'm wondering if I had some missing checks in the mail that I'm not even aware of. So I say that a little tongue-in-cheek, but I think the serious issue behind it is that sometimes you're not even aware of something that might be missing if you're not, you know, checking your accounts as well as you should be. So I guess I would just encourage you, when you go back to Representative McEwen, to really talk about not the value of these checks. There's undoubtedly a lot of value to the checks or the balance transfers that we get in the mail, but what kind of notification would work that, you know, whether it's opt-in or it's a notification, that really alert people to the fact that something's coming so they look out for it?
Sure. Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, I have, and I'll drop one of these by your office. This is a bank-specific one, but you know, this is a six-page how to prevent fraud on your account. You know, one of the things that I personally do is I check my accounts regularly online. You know, to see if there's anything there. Trust me, if you'd have lost checks and somebody would have stolen them and used them, you would know. Mm-hmm. Because all of a sudden you'd go, $10,000 in Paris? I was never in Paris. Mm-hmm. And there are amazing, I'm trying to think what the right word is. There are computer programs that I've had my credit card companies call and say, are you in Paris? You know, yesterday you were in Burns, Oregon, and today you seem to be in Paris. And obviously, or not obviously, but I probably wasn't in Paris. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are a lot of areas where you can protect yourself and how, you know, changing your PIN frequently, doing all these things. I haven't changed my PIN in 20 years, you know. Mm-hmm. But if I read this and was very diligent, I would change it every 6 months. Mm-hmm. So there are ways to protect yourself that already exist. And I think, you know, when you get your, if you get offers for credit, it's very clear in all these disclosures now, if you want to opt out, there's a number to call, there is an email to send to that says, I don't want this. And again, on the check side, if you got them for the first time and didn't realize you were going to get these, because usually there's a disclosure that said we may send you some of these things. If you get them and say, geez, I'm a little nervous about this, I don't think I want these, you can call and they'll shut them off. And our argument on opt-in and opt-out is we believe it's more beneficial to the consumer, because of the zero liability, to make a decision whether you want to opt in and opt out than just for us to assume everybody wants to opt out.
Thank you. I appreciate your comments. But I will say that, it does put consumers at risk because of these things are sent out, these offers are sent out. And maybe they financially can recover losses that they incur, but identity theft is something that has huge economic impacts to people as well. And so if it weren't for these offers going out, you know, it would help reduce the amount of opportunities for identity theft. And so it seems like the solicitation could just, you know, provide the opportunity for somebody to go ahead and order the checks or affirm that they want them and opt into it, as opposed to receiving all these throughout the world, you know, the country or the state in this case, and try to, there's a lot of checks are floating around there that, you know, people don't want and are subject to being stolen and, you know, therefore subjecting consumers to identity theft by the action of the solicitation. And I think this is a good issue to keep talking about. I appreciate your comments. I hope we're able to talk about this, even though it is February. I don't think it's as complicated as that. I guess we have a little disagreement about the opt-in, opt-out. But thanks a lot for your testimony. Appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, real quick.
He's mentioned a number a couple of times. Is this for each institution, or is there one number that somebody can call?
Mr. Chair, okay. Representative Thatcher, it is each institution has their own. It's on their disclosure and their statement, statement. And Mr. Chair, you're absolutely right. Identity theft is a big issue. We were very involved when we had this legislation several years ago, worked with your senator, Senator Prezansky, to get a good bill that, frankly, is a model for the nation. And so we were more than happy to continue to work on this.
Right. But it would take a lot of opt-outs, I think, to hit all the financial industry. Because they change their names regularly, you know, so I'd be opting out every week, probably.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Appreciate it. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4083 and open a public hearing on House Bill 4102. Jan, can you give us a description of House Bill 4102, please?
I will, Mr. Chair, committee members. This measure prohibits public and private post-secondary educational institutions from entering into contracts with financial firms to manage the student financial aid funds unless certain requirements are met, and declares an emergency effective on passage. Would you like the amendments each described?
I'm going to stand at ease for just a moment. Kind of odd, but I'm... Thank you for the brief interruption in this. I just wanted to announce that we are carrying over House Bill 4140. I apologize for not getting to you on that straight up at the beginning of the meeting. Just occurred to me as I glanced at the schedule, it wasn't noted. So that's House Bill 4140. We will not be hearing today. So with that, I probably don't have to reopen, but reconvening on House Bill 4102, opening the public hearing. And Jan, sorry for the interruption.
Yes.
Can you continue where you left off?
Would you like each of the amendments described?
Certainly.
Yes. Okay. So there's three committee amendments before you. The Dash 1 amendment that replaces the original measure prohibits the post-secondary schools from entering into contracts with financial firms to manage the student financial aid funds unless the following requirements are met. There has to be clear and concise disclosure of the fee schedule before the student agrees to use the account that's offered by the third-party vendor. There has to be an explanation of all the methods available to access the financial aid. There has to be the ability for the student to choose to receive financial aid through either a paper check or electronic funds transfer. And the paper check or electronic funds transfer has to be initiated within 3 business days of the student's request. And the fees or other charges to the student who chooses to receive a paper check or electronic funds transfer, fees would be prohibited. And it declares an emergency. It's effective on passage. The Dash 2 amendment, it prohibits the third-party vendor from charging a student any fee per transaction for making a debit or a similar transaction that uses a debit or similar card provided by that third-party vendor. And the Dash 3 amendment prohibits any parties from agreements that provide a revenue sharing that have revenue sharing agreements. It includes, but it's not limited to, payments from the third party vendor to the school that's based on student balances or activity in the accounts that are offered to the students by that third party.
Thank you. I appreciate that. We're going to start out with Eric Knoll and Sarah Shepherd. Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. And if you would start by identifying yourself before you provide your testimony.
Yes. For the record, my name is Sarah Shepherd. I'm a student at Lane Community College, which is in Eugene, and a member of the Oregon Student Association. Chair Holvey, Vice Chairs Lively and Richardson, and members of the committee. I would like to start off by saying that the potential to require more transparency in the dealings of financial firms that handle student money is a big and exciting step for students like me who seek an affordable education. For the sake of getting straight to the point, students are being charged by Higher One hidden debit swipe fees. When my colleagues and I ran a campus-wide campaign at Lane Community College, which informed students how to avoid Higher One fees that came out of their financial aid and scholarship money, about 3/4 of students that I spoke with were unaware of this debit swipe fee. That is why I call it a hidden fee. So each time a student enters their PIN number, they are charged 50 cents. To put it into perspective, if a student uses their Higher One debit card as debit, running it as debit.
Move the mic just away from you a little bit.
Sorry.
A little distortion. They're very sensitive. Thank you.
If a student uses their card as debit 3 times a day for 1 month, $45 will be charged to their financial aid in fees. On top of that, students are being charged at ATMs that are separate from Higher One, as there are only 2 Higher One ATMs that I know of in Eugene, and both of them are on campus. Students are charged $250 by the bank the ATM belongs to, $2.50 by Higher One, and 50 cents for using their PIN, totaling $5.50 each time. Being a part of the Oregon Student Association and being one of the many students that depend on scholarship and financial aid money, I am passionate about affordability of education. As we speak, students are using their Higher One debit cards and being charged various fees. If Higher One was based in Oregon, the profits made by Higher One would circulate within Oregon, but it is not. It is based in Connecticut, and I think that is unfortunate. When I first heard about this legislative concept, while it was still being drafted, my first reaction was, why does this have to go to the state level? Could it be handled by means of campus campaigns? But when I actually got out and talked to the students, the issue appeared larger than I first understood. Profits made off of aid are one thing. However, the lack of a conscious decision made by students to forfeit that money is another. The fair handling of student money, considering the major lack of student money, deserves to be put under the spotlight. I will feel proud to see Oregon defend their students. And it is with great urgency that I ask this committee to protect students' financial aid and pass House Bill 4102. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Holley, Vice Chairs Lively and Richardson, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Eric Knoll. I'm a student at PSU and serve as chair of the Oregon Student Association Board of Directors. Thank you for your time this afternoon, and thank you to Chair Holley for the invitation to return and testify before this committee. I'm here to speak in favor of House Bill 4102, relating to the management of student financial aid accounts, and to speak in favor of the proposed -1 through -3 amendments. OSA continues to support the passage of House Bill 4102 to provide students transparency, clarity, and reasonable expectations related to third-party financial aid disbursement. This bill and its proposed amendments will begin to address unusual and predatory fees, a lack of information about fee schedules related to financial aid disbursement from firms like Higher One, make additional options available to students without charge, and prohibit revenue sharing between institutions and firms. The amendments proposed by Chair Holvey are reasonable and provide additional clarity to the issues we are addressing in this bill. The -1 amendment, adding the requirement to provide a student with a clear and concise fee schedule before the student agrees to use the third-party financial aid firm, addresses some of the core issues students have with using Higher One. When surveyed at PSU last fall, only 22% of student respondents said they were confident they knew Higher One's fees. Based on the age demographics of the survey, 20% of respondents who identified themselves as 21 years of age or younger answered yes to the same question, scaling up to only 38% of the 40 to 55-year-old respondents. Those aged 22 through 29 answered 22% with yes, and age 30 through 39 answered only 21% yes that they knew Higher One's fees. This is not an issue of kids lacking fiscal responsibility, but a lack of transparency and availability of the fee schedule. Additionally, the -1 amendment requiring the third-party financial aid firm to seek to send a paper check to a student or initiate an electronic funds transfer within 3 business days of the date on which a student requested the funds addresses the desire for students to have an alternative to a Higher One card. 69% of PSU student respondents replied yes when asked if they would prefer an alternative to Higher One. Students aren't satisfied with the One card, and this amendment will provide a no-cost option to pursue an alternative. The -2 amendment prohibiting a fee from being charged to students per debit transaction directly addresses the unusual and predatory nature of Higher One's fees. When provided a debit card, students believe that it should be used as a debit card without cost. We believe there should not be a fee unique to students when other financial firms in an open market do not charge clients a debit swipe fee. The -3 amendment prohibiting revenue sharing between third-party firms and institutions is again reasonable and provides another direct answer to student concerns. We believe institutions who are already shifting the cost of financial aid disbursement in the form of fees assessed to student accounts should not be duly profiting on those fees. We are asking this committee to prioritize the needs of low-income students who use this service above the relationship between the institution and third-party financial aid firms. These amendments are excellent compromises in a discussion about the responsibilities of students, institutions, and third-party firms related to student financial aid disbursement. We urge the passage of House Bill 4102 with the -1 through -3 amendments. Thank you for your time, and we'll answer any questions if you have them.
Questions from the committee? Doesn't look like we have a lot of questions. I know you just testified, in, or at least Eric did, in January. You know, we have had many conversations about this proposal, and trying to figure out what is fair and what is not fair is oftentimes difficult when you look at what happens in the marketplace. And so we definitely have tried to narrow the scope of this bill dramatically. Not dramatic, but at least some, in an effort to really highlight some of the things that think might need addressed, and certainly the swipe fees, I think you've identified as being one that's not as common in the marketplace. It was difficult for us to really see the disclosure. It became an issue for us trying to really identify what kind of disclosure of the fee schedule exists, because we could not access the fee schedule because we're not students. You have to be able to get into the system to actually see a fee schedule. And we were unable to accomplish that, though I will say that we did meet with some of the schools, and they provided us some information about the fee schedules, and more recently Higher One came in and provided me with a copy of the fee schedule. And I will note that this issue has been around for a few years, as you probably know, and it has been evolving, and we recognize that there was recently a settlement with the U.S. Department of Education, I think, on some of these practices. And so I had some information about that I will share with the committee about that settlement and what the settlement was about. And certainly the swipe fee was one that was mentioned in as well. But the settlement doesn't necessarily prevent this from happening again, and so that's one of the reasons we decided to take a closer look at this. I know that Higher One does, have some contracts around the state, and they tend to have different contracts, I believe, with the different colleges and universities. And, from my understanding, that's due to when they actually implement those contracts. So some of these practices may have changed already. It's uncertain whether that change will be lasting or not. But I do appreciate their coming forward as well. But I think, committee, that we have got three amendments, and there has been talk of another one that I would like to ask you about, and that was the inactivity fee. And I didn't get any, though it was originally told to me about a student about inactivity fee going forward, where they had weren't using the account. They went to Europe for a while or something and came back, and the account had been charged $19 a month, I believe, is what was told to me, for inactivity. And then there was some other fees that were starting to compound and basically reducing the amount in the account. And I'm curious, have you... because it was another student that told me this. Have you heard any stories about that aspect of it?
Thank you, Chair Holvey, and members of the committee. We haven't heard, at least in my experience talking to students, a specific instance of this. However, we do have a significant number of qualitative responses from our PSU survey related to fees charged to students, and I wouldn't be surprised if some of those responses listed an example of a non-usage fee or an account research fee or something like that.
Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Not seeing any at this time. Thanks for participating in your government and trying to bring an issue forward. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, I have John Wyckoff and Brett Roulette. afternoon, gentlemen. If you would identify yourself for the record first, please.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Wyckoff. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Community College Association, representing Oregon's 17 community colleges. With me today is Brett Rolette from Lane Community College. And I'll just start by giving our sort of general position and then turn it over to Brett to talk a little bit about how it works on a campus. We were initially concerned with the fairly sweeping language in the first version of this, in that we were concerned that it was sort of a blanket removal of fees to accounts that would be, that many of which would be standard, I think, banking practice, that would have made it, unable for campuses to enter into contracts with a third-party vendor for the disbursement of financial aid. And that's really our concern here, is to maintain the flexibility to enter into contracts with third-party vendors for the disbursement of financial aid. And there's a reason for that. Disbursement of financial aid is something that is an intense operation for a short amount of time relative to the entire year. So it will be in any given academic term, you'll have about 4 or 5 weeks of a lot of activity that requires a lot of people to make it happen, and then you don't have anything for these folks to do after that. So for about 4 or 5 weeks of every term, you either ramp up with temps, which is difficult because this is work that requires a lot of training, and this is for some campuses creating a lot of inefficiency, not getting financial aid out on time. And so having this go to a vendor to be able to disperse that, and in a way where the campuses weren't having to either figure out something else for these folks to do in the time that they weren't doing this one very specific task, or ramp up with temps, it just wasn't a very good way to do it. And in many cases, you were seeing where financial aid wasn't getting out on time because of it. So that is our main concern here, is to be able to have the flexibility to do it that way. And we were concerned that in the first version it might have just led to not being able to do it, to have a contract to do work like that. In respect to the amendments, the dash one was something that we really proposed and is really current practice, and I think probably most of which would be covered under federal law. However, we thought it was important to have kind of a guarantee at the state level that our students, should they not want to use the option that is contracted at a college or university, know that they have the option to use their own checking account or get a paper check. What we didn't want to do is go back to a situation where you're basically giving out paper checks, because for a lot of our students, many of them are going to be what they would call unbankable. Portland Community College, our largest institution, estimates that about 30% of their students would not be eligible to get a regular checking account. So they would go to get a paper check and go to a check cashing place where they're going to be charged, 4% if their ID matches their address, and possibly up to 10% if it doesn't. And so we don't really see sort of going back to that as a very good option. But we want to make sure that students understand they can use their own checking account, and if they do want to get a paper check, they can do it. They can do it for free and get it in a reasonable amount of time. And that's why we used the 3 business days, I think, is the amount of time for that. And part of that is, I'm not a banker, but I'm not as familiar with the federal regulations, but my understanding is that a lot of the gap in that is about federal banking regulations for transfers between accounts, that there has to be somewhat of a lag. But again, I'm not the expert on that, but the folks that are that represent them, that's my understanding, that you do need some lag. And on our end, administratively, we need to have to have a certain amount of time to be able to make those transfers. But we want to make sure it's done in a timely way and that there's a guarantee of when it can be done. So we're very comfortable with that, and I think that that's a good guarantee for our students to have. So we proposed that, and we support it. The second piece on the PIN transaction fee, I'm not going to speak to whether that's a good fee or not. I think the main issue for us, and where it gives us a little bit of heartburn, is if that led to the unintended consequence of us not being able to enter into such contracts, that would be a problem. And we want to make sure it doesn't do that. I think that it's also worth thinking about, and I think I've heard a couple of you say, banking fees can sort of be like whack-a-mole, and if you have a narrow ban on one fee, it's just going to end up somewhere else. And I think that that's probably what would in some way would happen here. So I'm not sure it would address the issue, but for us, really, the issue is we just want to make sure we have the flexibility to enter into such contracts, and if an unintended consequence of this would be that we couldn't, that gives us some heartburn. On the third piece, the revenue sharing, we don't have any campuses that have a contract like that. My understanding is that's sort of something that's been grandfathered in from original contracts, from the earliest contracts with Higher One. They can speak to that better than I can. But we don't have any problem with that. If that was something, I mean, we think that that's if the state has an interest in saying that we're not going to go that route, we're perfectly comfortable with that. We think that it provides at least an appearance that there could be undue kind of influence to move towards these accounts, and we don't even want that appearance. So we'd be comfortable saying that that isn't a practice that is allowed. But for us, the main area where we'd have some heartburn would be over sort of a micromanaging of specific fees. And you also have to remember that we have locally elected boards who enter into these contracts and who always have a little bit of heartburn where at the legislative level, we're micromanaging what can and cannot be in contracts. Our boards feel very strongly that they are elected by their constituents to make those sorts of decisions on behalf of students and their constituents, and we have students involved in the process when we enter into these contracts, whether it would be with Higher One or with a local credit union or with a national or regional bank. And so I do also think it's important to remember we are talking about financial institutions. This isn't it isn't just Higher One that that submits bids for these kinds of contracts. And with that, I would turn it over to my colleague and let him talk a little about how this works on campus.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. For the record, Brett Rillette, Director of Governmental and Community Relations at Lane Community College in Eugene. Thank you for the opportunity to give some feedback on House Bill 4102 this afternoon. Why do campuses use these type of third-party vendors? Well, at Lane Community College, we started contracting with Higher One in 2008 for some of the reasons that John mentioned. We have a large percentage of unbankable students at Lane who were forced, once they received their financial aid checks, to go out to check cashing firms to incur those 4-10% fees in order to get their financial aid refunds. Additionally, we have a population of students that moves every summer. So if you send checks out in the mail, oftentimes they would either be returned to the college and we'd have to do a stop payment on those checks, or they would end up missing and it would just delay the students when the student would receive their refunds. We were typically doing financial aid disbursements during week 3 and 4 of the term. Since we moved to Higher One, which allows us to do electronic transfers of students' refunds, we now disperse financial aid in week 2, so we almost cut in half the amount of time that students have to wait in order to get their refund. Plus, the partnership has allowed the college to offer students a lot of services that we weren't able to do before. Before, it was basically paper check, take it or leave it. That was the one option. And now students have 3 options at Lane. All of them are free, no charge, to receive your money. You can have it deposited directly into your own financial institution, whether that's a bank or a credit union account. You can receive a paper check, or you can have a Higher One debit account set up. To have the money transferred from your student loan refund into your Higher One debit account, that's free, just like the other options. And if students don't choose an option, we don't default them into Higher One. It is an opt-in account. If they just choose not to respond to the emails and the mail, we will default them to receive a paper check to the address that they provide to the school when they enroll. As far as setting up the account, you know, we wanted to make sure that students are well aware of their choices. We start early. We've added to our campus orientation program a Money Matters program that talks about things such as responsible debt loads that students should take on, subsidized versus unsubsidized loans. But we also talk about financial aid disbursement. We let students know that when they receive the letter in the mail to set up their account, they have the option to use alternate options if that's what they'd like to do. For a lot of our students, they'll go with the Higher One option for convenience or because it's actually an account that is available to them. We're in our second contract with Higher One. We took a lot of student feedback after the first contract that we were in. I guess as Chair Holvey would say, it's kind of been an evolving process. But we wanted to make sure that students were aware of the options. So when they go on, they receive a letter in the mail to set up their account, they go to Higher One's website. Higher One does all of the work for the college. That's allowed us to greatly reduce what we were spending in this area and put it towards other student services on campus that we need to be focusing on. But when students are setting up their account online, they either, you know, they choose, I want to put it in my credit union account, or they choose hire one. If they go the hire one option, they have screen after screen that kind of walks them through. We wanted to make sure that there were safeguards in place. This was feedback from students just to make sure they understand the fee process. So the first process kind of
don't want to interrupt you, but to clarify, so when the students get presented with this choice of having it put into a different account, is that choice made available by the school, or is that choice made available through the Hire One system?
Hire One handles the disbursement process for us. Students make the choice by, they'll receive a letter in the mail that says to activate.
From who?
From Hire One.
Okay.
But it says go online, they go to a website, and that's where they make the decision. I want to use my own bank account, or I want to use Hire One, or if they don't choose either, then they get the paper check option. If they choose Hire One, not only does it talk about the account features and the rules of having the Hire One account, the next page that they go to shows them every fee that they could pay. And then we went one step further, and those fees, most of them are, you know, very average, what you would expect at any other financial institution. The next screen talks about the PIN fee versus the sign and swipe. If a student's using their debit card, let's say they go to Target, and they swipe it and sign it like a credit card, there is absolutely no fee to the student. If they use it as a PIN and enter in their PIN number, that's when a student incurs a fee. And that's the 50-cent fee that's been talked about. There's a lot of reasons for it. Any fee at a bank is used to help move behavior, whether it's to prevent you from bouncing checks or to prevent or to push you into doing a sign and swipe. And so Hire One makes more money off sign and swipe. They would like students to do sign and swipe. Then they try to push them in that direction. If students still don't understand and they go and use it and get assessed a PIN fee, our new contract, Hire One has to proactively contact the students and say, you've been assessed a PIN fee. This is why. This is how you avoid PIN fees. And you can have up to 3 of them reversed right now. Just call us. Let us know you understand. We'll reverse those fees. Let's say a student still goes beyond that. And this could be, you know, any fee that a student's assessed. If they come into our financial aid office, our financial aid staff has the authority to call up Hire One and reverse fees for students. They have $1,000 a term that they can do that with. I checked with our financial aid staff this morning. About 99% of the issues students have been coming in over the past year for Hire One have been lost passwords to access the website and lost cards, having to get a new card sent from the East Coast. There is a $20 fee to have a new debit card rushed from the East Coast, but our financial aid staff can waive that for students and have done that over and over. I guess that is, you know, what I've been asked to hit on today. I just wanted you to know that, you know, we agree, we want students to be aware of their options. We try to make sure at every point throughout the process of setting up the account, they understand that if they want to use an alternative option, that's there for them. It's free to do. If students choose Hire One and then decide 2 weeks into it that they want their money moved into a bank or a credit union account someplace else, that's where you can incur the wire transfer fee. But if you change your preferences and say, I no longer want the Hire One card, I want it moved into a credit union account, then there's no fee for doing that, and they'll just change your preferences for future disbursements.
Thank you. And just to clarify, so you do have the in your contract with financial firm Hire One a 50-cent PIN transaction fee, but you don't have in any of the community colleges the revenue sharing piece that the school gets money back based on the total amount of transactions, I guess.
Yeah, Chair Holby, members of the committee, we sent out kind of a questionnaire to our campuses about whether they used a third-party vendor, and in none of the contracts it appeared that there was that kind of revenue sharing agreement.
Thank you. Any other questions for this panel?
For clarification, it sounds like, John, you're in favor of the dash one and the dash three, and I'm wondering if that's correct and if that's how you feel as well.
As an association, we are. Yeah, I mean, it is the position of the association of the 17 colleges that we right now we're comfortable with the dash ones and the dash threes. I have a little bit of heartburn about the dash twos.
And Chair Hull, Representative Kinnegar, I would say that the college doesn't have a position on the bill. Looking at the proposed amendments, we already meet the requirements set forth in the transparency, the dash one amendments. Dash three amendments don't pertain to us, but I think the dash two amendments, it just takes out something that is available during the contract negotiations that the school has with Higher One. If Higher One, you know, like John said earlier, it's kind of a game of whack-a-mole. If it's not this fee, it's another fee. So if you ban that fee, then what are we dealing with the next time we go around? I like to think that, you know, we took the students' feedback to heart when they came to us and said we had issues about the PIN fee, and that's why we set up all the steps that it takes to open up a new Higher One account. That's why in the contract, Higher One has to proactively notify students if they're being assessed a PIN fee so they understand why and how to avoid that. You know, I think the Dash 2 amendments would just make it difficult in the future for us to negotiate contracts. It takes out one more thing. And I think we've proven that in this last go-around, we try to get the best contract we possibly can get for our students.
Thank you. And, you know, I did get a sheet that shows the PIN transaction fee, you know, at Higher One, and then it reviews several other banks, six banks and credit unions, where none of them have a PIN transaction fee. And I will note that sometimes there isn't an option for swipe and sign. Those aren't always available, so sometimes they do have to use their PIN transactions. So I just wanted to, you know, put that on the record. Don't see any other question. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned, talk about efficiencies in going into these third-party institutions. Is there any way you can quantify perhaps how many FTE you might either not have need of because you've gone this way, or perhaps maybe you redeployed them into other student-centered activities?
Chair, the Representative Johnson, that's it's a difficult question. I've asked numerous folks on our campus if they can estimate the savings to the campus, and basically, you know, looking at the first draft of the bill, if we weren't able to contract out those services, what would it cost?
Right.
And to kind of, to put it in an example that means a lot to students, for our students, if we went back to paper checks, it's about a dollar a credit increase if we had to come up with the funds on our own in order to pay for that. In order to get the school equipped to do the electronic transfers and all of that, we're looking at about $2 to $3 a credit because we don't have the infrastructure to do that. And a lot of financial aid disbursement isn't necessarily just a once-a-term event. We have students that are selected for verification by the federal government, so we have to verify all of their paperwork, their taxes, income, things like that, and that can stretch it into week 3, 4, 5, really whenever the students get the information in, and we can go through that process. So oftentimes it can happen once or twice a week where there's a disbursement. Since we didn't do electronic transfers prior to 2008, it was difficult for me to get an FTE figure out of our financial aid folks.
Appreciate that.
And if I may just speak broadly, Chair Holby, Representative Johnson, if I may just speak broadly sort of to the idea of to the efficiency point, I mean, I do think it's worth noting that at the beginning of the recession, the community colleges received about $500 million exactly from the state for the contribution towards running the community colleges. And throughout the recession, that went down about 20%. We got down to about $400 million, and we're serving about 30% more students. And so the colleges were making decisions about whether they were going to put the resources that were dwindling as their student population was exploding towards things like academic advising, things that drive completion, which is something that we're hearing a lot from legislators that they'd like to see more of, and had to decide that some of these more mechanical functions were things that they were going to have to be even more efficient on and find more efficient ways to do do so that they could put it into the classroom, into having more course sections for folks who were being laid off and looking for new skills. And so, I mean, this was sort of a form of triage for a lot of the campuses, is trying to prioritize the scarce funding that we have into things that drive student success and completion. And the disbursement of financial aid is something that can mechanically be done in a cheaper way by outside parties. It can allow us to focus the scarce funds that we get on I think the things that the state legislature has asked us to focus on.
Thank you. I appreciate your and lament your situation with your budget and the revenue you need to operate, although that's probably a different committee. We could propose a sales tax for dedicated for education, perhaps, to help with that endeavor, or just look for more general fund at the expense of other agencies, perhaps. But I will note that prior to 2008, though the colleges and the institutions are saving money, that cost has been, put back on the student through these fees. So they didn't have to pay those fees, I don't think, as much when they were getting the money prior to 2008. I don't think they were getting charged, PIN fees and, overdraft fees and those, all those sorts of fees. Now that are saving you money, the students are essentially paying those. And so it is a dynamic change, and I do recognize that there's a balance there somewhere, and that that's what we're trying to figure out, whether there is a little bit better balance, to help out the students, because they're also in financial tough times as well. And so we have to recognize that as well. And these monies are set aside to help with their education and to help pay tuition and get them through to a degree, and not really designed to go into a for-profit fee schedule. Even though it might save you a little bit of money, I would argue it doesn't save the students any money.
Well, and Chair Holvey, I would agree absolutely that when the state pulls back in its commitment to community colleges and universities, both, the students bear the cost, always, or the faculty. We usually have two options. We can cut course sections and cut access, or we can raise prices. And so when the state pulls back, yeah, you're absolutely right. The students bear the cost.
But we need to convince the public to raise revenue.
So, Chair Holvey, I just want to affirm what you said, and it's not just passing on to students, but it's which portion of the students are bearing that cost. So it's the ones receiving financial aid. So I think that's why we're looking for the sweet spot.
And in our population, I mean, that's right. I mean, that's most of our population,
right?
That are eligible. They don't receive it because we run out of money in Oregon.
What percentage is it?
I'd have to go back and look, but that's why, again, we're dealing with students, more students who would be not even eligible for a bank account because they're, because they've run into a situation where their credit has been hurt so badly that, and this is where I think when you're looking at these fee schedules, that's why they don't compare necessarily, because I think I read that the PIN transaction fee is something only utilized by about 8% of the industry. So it's not just Higher One, and there are some banks moving, I think, towards something like this. But they're serving a population they would otherwise just say no to and just walk away from.
And I appreciate we really do need to move on. I get reminded that our time schedule's a little bit shorter than it has been in the past. So thank you very much for your testimony. Up next, I have Joe Holliday, Darren Matthew, and Courtney
Tacchini.
Good afternoon and welcome. If you'd give us your name before you testify, or go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joe Holliday. I currently serve in the Oregon University System Chancellor's Office as an Assistant Vice Chancellor. And my role today is to provide brief background on the history of our public universities using Higher One and other financial institutions, and then to pass it on to my colleagues from Portland State and Oregon Tech, if that's all right. Okay, thank you. So the Oregon University system has been contracting with HireOne since approximately 2004. Portland State University was the first university to contract with them. At the time, Portland State was growing rapidly, and the student lines at financial aid refund time were growing, and they were approximately 45 minutes to 1 hour of wait time for students. They wished to respond to that. In addition, some of the students, and to this day, some of the students did not have a bank account or access to a bank account in which to deposit their refund check. So they contracted with HireOne, and that relationship really solved both of those issues, the lines and students who did not have access to a bank account. They specified from the beginning, and I believe they still specify, and Darren can verify that, that there not be per transaction or swipe fees in the contract with HireOne. Since then, two other public universities have contracted with HireOne, Oregon Institute of Technology and Southern Oregon University. Two other institutions, Western Oregon University and Eastern Oregon University, contract with U.S. Bank, I believe, for much more limited services, so that four of the seven universities are using them. And that's really the background I wanted to provide, and we have first up Darren Matthews from Portland State University.
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Darren Matthews. I'm the Director of Contracting and Procurement for Portland State University. Also serve on the business faculty, ironically teaching government contracts to our students. With me is Amanda Nguyen, who's the Associate Director of our Student Financial Services. And while I'm involved with the negotiation of the HireOne contract and many others, Amanda works weekly, sometimes daily, with the HireOne contract and how we serve our students. We at Portland State, nothing is more important to us than our students, and so we fully support this committee's look at transparency and service to students. We want the very same thing, and we work diligently with associated students of Portland State University, our student faculty, as well as the Mr. Knoll and his association, the Oregon Student Association. We've met with both of them, and we're, I believe, in a unique position where we're actually having representatives of these student groups negotiate and discuss our contract terms with HireOne. In fact, that's coming up. So I just want to acknowledge that we're working actively with our students to make sure that we take student surveys, we take into their account their needs and what's happening with them. Just real briefly, an overview of our contract. We've been with HireOne quite a bit of time. This year we're up for renewal, extension, if you will. Our contract does not have the PIN fee. There are other fees associated that our students do let us know about, but the PIN fee, we don't have that in our contract at Portland State. Approximately 70% of our students do receive financial aid, and our split is about 65% choose the HireOne card, 35% choose their own bank account, and about 10% receive checks. So we want the options for our students. We insist on those options. We try to convey, and maybe we need to more clearly convey what those options are, and work with HireOne in doing that, because as was mentioned before by the testimony from our student representatives, a lot of the students seem to be unaware of the fees, and so we want to make sure that that's
Can I ask you a question in the middle of this about the options?
Yes.
So the option for a student to have an ACH to their own account, does that option go through HireOne, or does that go directly from the school?
It ultimately goes through HireOne, but initially it's through Portland State. Through our orientation, the students are instructed, these are your options, and even our website with Amanda's department. It lists the three options, and incidentally, we list as the first option, just in order of sequence, a direct deposit to your bank account. And then they would actually go onto HireOne site and register or sign up.
So they still have to go to the HireOne site to accomplish that?
That's correct.
Thank you.
So with regard to the Dash 1 through Dash 3 amendments, I would just say we also don't want to see any unexpected consequences out of the legislation, but either the items mentioned in the amendments are items that are currently in our contract, items that we're currently working on, such as the revenue sharing, or items we feel that we could adjust and negotiate as needed with our contract in conjunction with our student body.
So unlike the community colleges, they have the swipe fee, you do not in your contract, but you do have the revenue sharing, which they do not have.
That is correct.
Good afternoon, Chair Representative Holsey and members of the committee. Thank you for inviting me and us to testify on House Bill 4102 today. My name is Courtney Tacchini. I am the Director of Business Affairs at Oregon Tech. I think we have discussed the Higher One process in detail here and the options that are available to students. Oregon Tech is pretty similar to most of the other schools that we've discussed. We do have a slight fee for debit-only transactions. And as a representative of a smaller school, it is more difficult for a smaller institution to have that bargaining power in those contracts with companies like Higher One, where we want to be able to utilize their services for a benefit of the business office and the school, and eventually, obviously, the students, because we can have lower tuition and fees and we have lower administrative costs. However, it is very difficult for a smaller school to make those kind of bargaining options with a large institution like Higher One. So that part of the bill that speaks to deducting no fees at all would make our bargaining with Higher One. Our contract comes up in December of 2016, so at that point we may have to look at choosing another provider, because they do have that fee associated with the account. But we want to let you know that the students have a variety of options. So on the one account, which is the Higher One account that they choose, if they so choose to opt into that program, they have obviously the three options that we've already discussed, where they can direct deposit into their own account, go for a paper check, or they can use Higher One's one account. With the one account, they also have many no-fee options. So they can swipe it as a charge card, as we've talked about, where you're signing for the swipe. They can also use the ATM on campus to get all of it out in cash on campus with no fee associated. And they can also, you know, wire it to another account or whatever. But there are many options that the student has with the one account that are also no fee. So the student has a variety of options that have no fee, and there's just really that one fee associated with only those debit transactions. So the student has lots of ways to get that money out without any fee associated. And I have a great deal of our materials that we hand out to them as examples of how we are educating those students. We also have as part of our registration events, we offer them a course to tell them about the program and make sure that everything is as transparent as possible. So we do our very best to make sure that everyone is aware of that. So I think I will kind of skip going through the rest of the written testimony that I've provided. But we just want to make sure that the committee understands that there are both benefits to the student and to the institution as a part of being able to use a financial firm like Higher One. And we would like to be able to continue to utilize this financial firm to both benefit the students and the organization.
Thank you. Just a quick question. Something occurred to me that I also heard was the actual card, the debit card they get, also has the name of the institution on it. Is that accurate?
That is the case with Portland State.
So your card says Portland State on it?
Ours does not.
Yours does not. So that's sort of, although I didn't ask that of the community colleges, but it was just something of interest. You know, I appreciate your comments, and, you know, there was no intent by this legislation to prevent you from entering into a contract with Higher One or any other financial firm. We were just looking at some of these practices that have been pointed out by the U.S. Department of Education.
Absolutely.
And as well, some of the practices that we see going on with our state institutions, and they all have different contracts, and some have the swipe fee, negotiate that out, some don't. And so, in this world of our individual boards, I hate to suggest, but, has there ever been any thought about, having a negotiation for all the schools, because you complain about not being big enough to negotiate with Higher One to get a decent contract that Portland State gets, perhaps? But, I mean, I don't know, has the OUS thought about that? Not that maybe they have that in their power still. I'm not sure they do. But.
Yes, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. To my knowledge, it has not been discussed in any detail with the campuses. This is something that has been delegated to the campuses for quite a long time. So.
Interesting. Okay.
Representative Lively.
So I just have a question. I keep hearing people talk about the contracts. So is there a designated time that the contracts run to be, or is that negotiated too, is how long they're for, renewal, et cetera?
Yeah, Chair Representative Holding and Vice Chair. We, each institution has their own contract that runs on its own time period.
Okay.
So it would be institution specific.
Great. Any other questions?
Just
Representative Johnson.
One thought comes to mind. I'm wondering, does Higher One or any of these financial institutions do any sort of testing as to the credit ratings of the students within a specific institution, i.e. there could be variations between certain student populations that might, their cost may be less in certain institutions than other, and therefore there could be better rates available for students than there would be in other institutions, or is that not factored in?
Chair Representative Holding and Representative Johnson, provided on my Appendix 1, the...
Is it in here?
Yeah, Higher One does not provide or doesn't do a credit check on their students.
Okay, just check. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony today and coming forward and, you know, having a candid conversation about it. Really do appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Up next, I have George Okulich.
I couldn't tell if they were. If they were
I think it's likely the same. I'm going to guess.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee.
The university.
Did you introduce yourself for the record?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is George Okulich, here on behalf of Higher One. I'm going to try to skip sections of the of my testimony today just because I think you've heard it a couple of times, but forgive me if I, you know, stumble into a few things that we've talked about a few times. Higher One was essentially founded by college students and works with colleges and universities to provide a broad array of payment, refund, disbursement, and management tools to help institutions save money and enhance effectiveness of dealing with financial aid, while at the same time trying to provide students with flexible and affordable transactions options to help them manage their finances. I've heard a few things just to clarify. You know, we just manage the financial aid. We're not a credit card company. We don't do loans. We don't do mortgages. It's purely a financial aid institution. Skipping a few things. So prior to the introduction of electronic disbursement programs, the majority of higher education institutions used were paper-driven. It took weeks and weeks for students to receive their funds. It's one of the reasons these college students decided to try to find a faster way to deliver money quicker to students. And then this is sort of a growing trend nationally. The movement towards electronic disbursement of funds have grown dramatically. In 2008, the U.S. Department of Education regulations were amended to explicitly encourage electronic delivery of funds and allow higher education institutions to basically contract out with these third-party institutions. And this growth of electronic disbursements has helped hundreds of colleges and universities eliminate inefficiencies and avoid millions of dollars of expenses. In Oregon, Higher One has helped institutions do approximately 950,000 disbursements for students. And their Higher One's platform allows students to receive their financial aid and other refunds faster while ensuring students are offered value, choice, transparency, and financial literacy. And as we talked about, you know, when you enter in, when you get your financial aid disbursement, you do have those sort of three free options: to get a paper check, to have it transferred into your personal institution, and to open up a Higher One account. Higher One has created optional high-value checking account services that are accessible to all college students, and that's one of the things that we pride ourselves on. We are an alternative for students who are essentially unbankable by other institutions, and this allows them to increase their credit scores, to, you know, to establish relationships with banks. And you know, and unfortunately, some of these students are subject to other predatory lending practices. And we do go out, we do surveys. One of the reasons people do like working with Higher One is, you know, you can go down to your sort of payday loan, you know, company and get, you know, cash in your check. You know, we also assume the process, you know, the exemption handling for students and shift burden away from institutions. We deal with, you know, loss and undeliverable checks. We, you know, fix incorrect ACH information. A lot of these expenses are time-consuming and costly for institutions.
So one of the issues I was going to talk about is transparency, and it's something that HireOne believes strongly in. So last year, the Pew Charitable Trust did a study entitled Checks and Balances, Measuring Checking Accounts for Safety. You know, they looked at the nation's 50 largest banks, you know, focusing on 36, and specifically looked at disclosure, overdrafts, and dispute resolution. HireOne has attempted to try to model all their fee schedules and disclosure forms according to what the Pew Charitable Trust recommends in terms of best practices, and there's sort of best practices, good practices, acceptable practices. We really strive for best practices, and if we put HireOne's disclosure statements and fee schedules up against that Pew Charitable Trust, you know, we'd be number two in the nation. So we're pretty proud of that. One of the other things that we offer for the institutions is we, having gone to this electronic system, is really help institutions, you know, prevent becoming victims of financial aid fraud by auditing a lot of their existing enrollments, doing a lot of sort of detailed analysis of student information. You can figure out pretty quickly, you know, it's a matter of seconds if, you know, if there's certain red flag things that are popping up where students are dropping out of one institution, getting financial aid, moving to another institution. We can detect that in seconds, and it's another thing that has sort of helped out sort of institutions. In terms of costs, a lot of what we're talking about is fees. One of the things that HireOne likes to say is we should look at fees as sort of an aggregate, sort of a total system. You know, I kind of probably agree with John a little bit in terms of the whack-a-mole. It's HireOne has lower, we're actually cheaper across the board in terms of national banks and regional banks. You know, on it's estimated that an average student spends about $45 a month in fees and expenses, which is extremely cheap compared to what other institutions spend. But we also realize, you know, the key thing here is choice, and we really want to allow students to have choices available. And so for some students, we realize HireOne isn't an option. And we encourage folks to find what works best for them. But we believe that limiting, taking away HireOne, preventing us from existing, you know, is, again, limiting student choice. So we continue to share the goals that students should be provided with access to low-cost banking options that maintain that they're transparent, that they're easy to understand, that they provide consumer protections. And these are the sort of central factors that the universities and the community colleges work on when they contract with us, is try to figure out, you know, what's best for everyone. So just moving into a couple of the amendments, you know, on the record, I have sent them off to HireOne. They are looking through them right now, so I don't have, you know, an official position. I will tell you, just basically per our conversations, you know, number one, sort of the clear and concise transparency, again, is something that we aspire to do and probably would support an amendment similar to that. Two, the fee bill, obviously one that does, you know, cause us some problems and may prevent some of our contracts with some of our institutions, and may increase fees in other areas. Three, in terms of the revenue sharing, again, that is something that we would support. You know, we actually only revenue share with two institutions, Portland State University and Southern Oregon University are the two institutions that we do revenue sharing with. And it's actually been something that HireOne has tried to get away from. We prefer not to revenue share, but the institutions actually have liked it and have asked us to continue with that process. So, again, looking at the details in the language, if you feel like moving forward, I think that's something we could support. And I think you did mention a fourth one about the delinquent account fees, that there might be an amendment. As of last year, in none of our accounts do we charge a delinquent account fee, so that one should be fine as well. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Can you tell me what's the policy reason, I guess, to have a revenue sharing piece where the educational institution gets a percentage of the transaction amounts?
So, Chair Holby, again, that was something that happened, I think, you know, early on in 2000, sort of as the institution started entering into these contracts with HireOne, and it was simply from the universities to deal with some of the administrative burden of doing these accounts. So it was, and, you know, we.
I thought Higher One was doing the accounts.
Well, we were doing the accounts, but I'm saying in terms of, like, our relationship with the institution and making sure that, you know, as we transitioned from the paper checks into the electronic disbursements, that the institutions did have some administrative costs there that they wanted to be reimbursed for. Higher One would prefer that they go to just a monthly subscription fee. So we would favor moving away for it, but probably a better question would be to some of those institutions who preferred the revenue sharing.
And so you mentioned, you know, flexibility. So why do some contracts have a 50 cent swipe fee and other contracts do not? What benefit to the institution is that?
Yeah, Representative Holvey, again, you know, I think it has to do with every institution's individual needs. You know, for some of them, you know, there are a variety of other programs that, you know, the Higher One works on. But, you know, there's literacy or financial aid sort of literacy programs. There's wealth management programs. There's just sort of a slew of other things. You know, for some, you know, it might be lower cost to the institution, and so there's additional fees. But again, I think it's sort of part of the contracting. Our fundamental sort of position has been the fee, that 50 cent sort of debit fee, has worked because it has kept down the entire cost of, you know, for students in terms of keeping the overall cost low. A lot of these checking accounts are free. You know, a lot of the transaction fees are free. We do have a, you know, different accounts, Account Edge, where it's just a $4.95 a month and all our fees are free. But again, I think it's looking at that aggregate to sort of say, you know, our folks would argue that, you know, if that amendment passed, that unfortunately students will probably see a fee increase somewhere. But right now, having that debit fee, you know, has kept things low. And one of the things we've done is encourage ways to, like, avoid it.
So since Portland State does not have the fee, the swipe fee, you think the students there have a higher cost than the students at the community college then?
Chair Holvey, I would have to look at, I don't have the various contracts in front of me with the various two different institutions, what some of the other programs are. I mean, PSU is a revenue sharing, community college is not. I couldn't tell you the exact.
So just one last question. So since I see that Higher One has some contracts with swipe fees, some without, some with revenue, some without, I would guess that Higher One wouldn't refuse to enter into a contract that didn't have swipe fees, for example, because they already do enter into contracts like that and vice versa with the revenue sharing.
Rep. Holvey, I would, you know, that would be probably a better question for them. I would imagine, you know, that's the case, but there would probably be other, conditions in that contract that we'd have to take a look at.
All right, fair enough. Thank you. Questions for Representative Kenny Gillier?
Thank you. So 45 average a month is like 450 in fees. I think that's what you said, right? Average $45 in fees a month per student?
And it might even, and mm-hmm. I might have misspoke, it might have been $45 a year.
Okay.
And
so
I can tell
you, love
compared to about 300.
Yeah,
I can give you that.
Because that actually sounds really high to me. And I assume this is privately held company. So I don't know if this...
They have been a privately held company. I understand. Again, I'd have to look at them, but a year or two ago, they did go public.
Okay.
But I would, again, have to.
So is Higher One actually a bank registered with FDIC?
Yes.
So is it then, could you get information to us about, I get that this is a higher cost population to serve, and I appreciate that there's that option. Is it public information how much of that $45 fee actually goes toward the cost to Higher One versus the profit?
Yes.
That is public information?
That is public information.
That would be really
helpful.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Smith.
Thank you.
Quiet over there.
I was intrigued with, I think, your initial comment that you said that this company was originally created by college students.
Yes.
Is that someone who went to college or college students? I mean, help me understand.
Give
some history on that.
Students back east that were, I think they were juniors in college and basically were frustrated with, you know, waiting an hour in line at their financial aid office, you know, to basically be told now you can't get your financial aid check for 2 weeks, and said, There's got to be a better way.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet. Other questions? Thank you, Mr. Okulich. Appreciate you coming forward. Appreciate the visit to my office, and I hope we can talk soon.
Sure.
Up next, I have Aaron Knott.
Chair Holding, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Attorney General in the Department of Justice, here in support of House Bill 4102. And to give you some context about why I'm here, the Attorney General, just in the same way that you have your sort of bank of issues that you monitor as state legislators, we maintain a certain level of awareness of national trends, litigation trends, activity by the federal government. And we have been following this issue, not so much from an Oregon perspective. In fact, I'll confess that I know less about the specifics of what the previous testifiers have been speaking about probably than anybody else in the room, but we do track it nationally. So the Attorney General asked me to come in and share with you a few of the observations of national trends in support of what we feel is an important conversation. This area of the use of sort of financial intermediaries to handle financial aid accounts at universities has been the subject of action from the Department of Education. The FDIC had a significant settlement in this area. There have been class action lawsuits and recently an investigation from the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. And I don't bring those up because I'm here to bash these sorts of agreements. In fact, I think, as previous testimony has indicated, and it's consistent with our own look at it, there's a lot of good to be had in these arrangements. They can be a significant cost saver. We've heard repeatedly that they lead to faster and more efficient distribution of financial aid money, which can save FTE. It's convenient for students with appropriately placed ATMs. It's a good way to have a streamlined sort of financial system all operating on campus. And those are real dollars, and the Department of Justice sees no problem with that. But the trends we've seen in the national litigation concern more a lot of what you've been hearing about in terms of fees and then a certain amount of the revenue sharing we wanted to speak about as well. Several of the testifiers have said in one form or another that fees are a bit like whack-a-mole, and I think there is some truth in that. At the same time, not all fees are equivalent. Certainly that hasn't been the trend in anything we've looked at. For example, the FDIC in their settlement held that if you have an overdraft, say, that comes in, you can't keep charging recursive fees over and over and over on the same overdraft, basically putting account further and further into arrearage, and then automatically deduct that when the next batch of financial aid comes in. So clearly, a fee is not necessarily a fee. It's not always apples to apples. But as I've been listening to the testimony, the two things I've been thinking about with these fees are how they're disclosed in terms of, and this will come back to choice, and then again, the ease with which they can be avoided. And I think the reason that a lot of the conversation drills down on the swipe or PIN fees is because that is a point-of-sale transaction that's made hundreds of times by a student, probably hundreds of times a month, and it can be very difficult to avoid. So it's naturally the subject of some significant attention. The issue of choice in terms of students having the ability to make an informed decision, we are very pleased with the testimony we've heard that everyone seems to be prioritizing that. Suppose I would only make the remark that how that choice is presented is very important. There is a particular hazard with this sort of contract that the line between what is the school and what is the financial provider can start to blur. If you see presentations being made by the school containing not advertisement, but even just information about the financial provider who it may be higher one, but it may be somebody else. They're a market leader, but there are others out there. It can create some conflation that this is actually the school that is providing you with these cards. And I think that can be difficult to parse out. The other point I'd like to make, and something we wanted to emphasize about why we feel this is appropriate for you to be taking a look at, is you're hearing a lot of very good and, I think, progressive movement on how these contracts are being handled, more attention being paid to the nature of the fees, knocking out the ones that are sort of the biggest problem, and trying to be progressive to the response of students, the responses of school administrators. But the point I would make in return is that those are being done by contract, and the fact that PIN fees aren't present here in Oregon at this time shouldn't suggest that they'd never be present here, have never been present here, or aren't present elsewhere. So I just want to make that point to the committee, because contracts are wonderful things. They give the schools the opportunity to actually meet halfway with a service provider to get exactly what that school needs. And it's no surprise that they vary from school to school. But the fact that a contract specifically excludes a practice that you as a legislature do not want to see does not mean that it couldn't spring up elsewhere. So in closing, the Attorney General is really just having me here to offer our help, our support, and to encourage you to continue to take a look at this very important issue. It's cropping up on our side of the aisle as well, and I wish you the very best in, to paraphrase Representative Kenny Geyer, finding the sweet spot on this issue. I'm open for any questions.
Thank you. And we don't have any time for questions for you.
Have some mercy. Thank you.
So I appreciate your testimony. Appreciate the Attorney General as well. So please relay that for me. And with that, committee, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4102. Unfortunately, or fortunately, we will be carrying over House Bill 4132, and as previously noted, House Bill 4140. So, any other business, Jan? Nope. With that, I adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency. Government Efficiency. Consumer Protection.